From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When we think of a weapon that defines a war, that empowers one side and frustrates the other, we might think of battleships, of new longer-range artillery pieces, of tanks, maybe a revolutionary rifle like the Kalashnikov. Well, the war in Iraq has been dominated by a different kind of weapon. Two-thirds of American combat deaths and a larger share of combat injuries have been caused by explosives that the Pentagon calls improvised explosive devices, IEDs. They've been detonated by suicide bombers, by remote control devices, by sensors of various degrees of sophistication. The IED is the subject of a four-part series this week in the Washington Post. It's called Left of Boom, and it's by the Post's award-winning military correspondent, Rick Atkinson. Welcome.
Thank you,
to
Robert.
The program. First, the title Left of Boom, it invokes a timeline.
Yes, it's a metaphor that the Army came up with back in 2003, right after the invasion of Iraq, and they thought of a timeline in terms of, if you think of the boom, right of boom is after the blast has occurred, and you're looking to mitigate the effects of the blast at that point with heavier armor or perhaps better trauma care. Left of boom means anticipating the blast. That can be everything from trying to jam the radio waves that trigger the blast or finding the cell that is building and disseminating the bombs. So the effort for more than 4 years has been to move the whole counter-IED effort left of boom.
Was the military quick to figure out that this would be the most important weapon that they're facing?
I would say they were pretty slow to figure it out, actually. Certainly there was not an anticipation before the invasion in March of 2003. There was no substantial effort to take care of the vast amount of munitions that Saddam Hussein had accumulated, up to 1 million tons of munitions, which form the basis of any IED, the explosives. It was really not until the summer of 2003, long after Baghdad had fallen, that there was a realization that the IED was not only a tactical problem, but that it was potentially a strategic problem. And you had General Richard Cody, who was then the operations chief, in the late summer of 2003, calling his staff together and saying, "We've got to stop the bleeding."
You recount in this series these many efforts to deal technically with the problem, that to come up with some sort of countermeasure that would thwart the device just left of boom. It's a very big technical effort.
It's much more complex than it had been anticipated. John Abizaid, who became the Central Command commander in the summer of 2003, believed that U.S. industry, U.S. science would find a way to stop it. The truth of the matter is it has proven to be much more complex, much more difficult. There is no silver bullet. I think that's widely acknowledged now. And in the 4 years since then, there have been efforts that have ranged from looking at microwaves and lasers to soldiers in the field improvising their own efforts to try to come up with a countermeasure. And we've had a relentless cycle of measure, countermeasure, countermeasure.
Who, in short, is planting the IEDs?
Well, they believe that there is somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 cells that are operating in Iraq. Now, a cell that is involved in bombing usually is 5 to 7 people. There is a financier. There is usually a bomb maker, somebody with some technical education. At the bottom of their food chain are emplacers, and these are usually mercenaries, not ideologues. They're paid anywhere from $25 to $200 to plant a bomb. They're given a bonus if they kill an American soldier. And they're across the political spectrum. Initially, it was mostly Sunnis, those disenfranchised by the ouster of the Ba'athist government. Since then, it has expanded considerably. The most ferocious sorts of IEDs are believed to be linked to Iran. They are clearly found first and foremost in Shiite areas. And so you have everything from Sunni to Shiite to criminal gangs who are using IEDs.
Most the ones that you're speaking of that have been linked to Iran are the explosively formed penetrators, the EFPs. How dangerous a weapon is that?
They're very nasty. An EFP essentially is made from a copper disc. It's called a liner. It has a concave shape, 140 degrees, which is just right for their purposes. It can be anywhere from 2 to 11 or 12 inches in diameter. When a plastic explosive detonates behind the disc, it inverts this copper disc so that it comes out in what's called a slug. An 8-inch EFP is 7 pounds of copper. traveling after it's detonated at Mach 6. That's 2,000 meters a second. Usually the range is 5 to 10 meters. It'll blow through virtually anything we've got. To give you a comparison, 7 pounds of copper traveling at 2,000 meters per second, the 50 caliber machine gun slug, which is one of the most devastating projectiles on the battlefield, weighs 2 ounces. The muzzle velocity of a 50 caliber machine gun is 900 meters, so it's less than half.
One thing that that you write about, it's actually, I think, going to be in tomorrow's part of the series, is the inventiveness of troops in Iraq and ways in which they figure out how to misdirect projectiles with stuff that they're buying in Baghdad.
Yeah, you can never underestimate the inventiveness of the American soldier or Marine. That's certainly true. For example, EFPs are frequently triggered with something called PIR, passive infrared. It's a sensor that detects something warm going past. So soldiers quickly realized that it was necessary to get a decoy, something warm in front of their Humvees. So you had proposals, for example, that a giant hairdryer be mounted on the bumper to blow hot air in front of the vehicle. Soldiers actually got a toaster that they bought in a bazaar someplace, plugged it into the Humvee, put it on the end of a pole dangling in front of the Humvee.
Did it actually attract missiles of some sort?
The toaster I don't know about, but there's the son of toaster, essentially called Rhino, and there are now thousands of Rhinos out there. Rhino is a heating device used in diesel engines. It heats up the box. You put it on a pole. The pole dangles in front of the bumper at the front of the convoy, and those have attracted insurgent bombs. Now, in 4 to 6 weeks after the Rhino first appeared, the insurgents simply adopted their own countermeasure, which was to angle the bomb so that instead of firing right at the hot device, it was angled 10 feet back, in this case at the Humvee.
Well, we've been talking about the technical means of trying to defeat various kinds of improvised explosive devices, but another activity that would happen left of boom on the timeline would be to break up the cell, to get intelligence on who's making bombs. Has the military had any success with this?
The effort really in the past year has been not so much to defeat the device, but to attack the network. And this requires extraordinarily good intelligence. It requires a hand-in-glove relationship between intelligence and operations. I think, you know, it's fair to say that they've had some success, particularly in the last 6 months. There's now a new organization that correlates all of the national intelligence from CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. All of this is put together, sent to brigades in Iraq in an effort to make them more agile. And that's the name of this game, really. It is an effort to make the U.S. military more agile.
Rick Atkinson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
It's military writer Rick Atkinson of The Washington Post talking about the series that runs through Wednesday about improvised explosive devices. It is called Left of Boom.